Good afternoon. Calling State Affairs to order at 3:15 p.m. Thursday, April 28, 2022. We're in the Max Grunberg Room of the Capitol. Members present from my left to my right, Representatives Vance, Kaufman, Eastman, and myself, Chair Kreis Tompkins. We also have Representative Tarr on the phone. That gives us five members present in a quorum to conduct business. Representative Story previously advised us she'll be here a little bit late, plans to be here. And before we dive in, our usual thanks to Lydia, to my or rather Lydia in the back of the room, and Sophia to my right, and as well as Jeff Stepp for facilitating today's meeting. And housekeeping items: HB 309 has been removed from today's agenda, pending the production of a CS and amendment deadlines. SB 25, Senator Bielikowski's bill on the online checkbook. Amendments should be submitted to Legislative Legal Sunday, 5 p.m., and submitted to my office Monday by 5 p.m. For HB 31, Daylight Saving Time. Oh, interesting. Leg Legal short title, I think it's Daylight Saving Time without an S. So that's something that gets people all the time. But the short title is Savings with an S. Anyway. Daylight Saving Time year-round, that's also Sunday, 5 p.m. to Legislative Legal, 5 p.m. Monday to my office, mirroring SB 25. And then amendment deadlines for two other bills, SB 95, which is Senator Wilson's Search and Rescue Surplus State Property Legislation, submit to Legislative Legal Tuesday, 5 p.m., and to my office Wednesday at 5 p.m., and then finally SB 182, Interference with Emergency Services, the Senator Wilson's bill, submit to Legislative Legal Tuesday, 5 p.m., and to my office Wednesday at 5 p.m. Representative Kaufman.
Yes, if you would please repeat the one before HB 31, the bill that you referenced first, I think it was?
Yeah, that was Senator Wielikowski's SB 25, the online checkbook or state government finances website legislation, Sunday, 5 p.m. to legal, and then to my office Monday, 5 p.m., and we'll communicate all of this by email.
Okay, that'll be helpful.
Yes, yes. Sorry. We'll always have the amendment deadlines out by email.
Just comment on that. You guys do a great job, so thank you. It's much more clear than what we get in some cases.
I would just note by we guys, really, it's Jeff Stepp.
But I'll
exist in the halo. No, thank you for that, Representative Kaufman. It's appreciated. I think we're all in admiration with the attention to detail that Jeff administers with keeping the committee running. We have two items on today's agenda, HB 66. It was my hope that we would get a CS back from Legislative Legal from hearing from the drafters. We don't yet have that back, but we will distribute it as soon as we do get it from Legislative Legal to the committee. And I'm interested in, assuming the CS comes, say, later tonight or tomorrow, which I think is in the realm, distributing it to the committee, and then also concurrently running an amendment process. So if people have amendments that they want to run against that CS, they can prepare those, and we could start taking amendments up on Tuesday. So we'll see when we actually get the CS from legal, but I want to try to move forward as best we can. And then we also have SB 66 today, and there were five amendments submitted by deadline that we'll consider, although per some conversation before committee, we may hold the bill to allow for some further dialogue between the sponsor and members of this committee. So on HB 66, the idea is to continue to give members the opportunity to ask questions of the sponsor and those online. And speaking of those online, we have Hillary Hall of the National Voter Home Institute, Tom Flynn with the Department of Law, and Gail Fanumiai, Director of the Division of Elections, as well as Representative Tuck and Mr. Mason, staff to Rep Tuck in the room. And I cut things off just with time in mind last week, but we can just dive back in. I just want to make sure all members have the opportunity to exhaust any and all lines of questioning while we wait on the CS. So are there questions for any of those available on HB 66? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Where to start? Try and pick up back where we left off earlier.
while you find your place, just to note, Representative Klayman joined us at 3:20 p.m.
Great. Section 49 deals with the definition of election fraud. And it states, currently, a person commits the crime of election fraud if the person violates Alaska Statute 1556060. And that makes sense to me. But then it also goes on to say, basically, but only if the violation changes the outcome of an election. And that I'm not so sure about. Why would we want to say that the same action, which is fraudulent, dealing with the election, both is and isn't election fraud based on the outcome of the election, which would hopefully be something outside of their control?
Representative Tuck.
For the record, Representative Chris Tuck from South Central Anchorage, District 23. Very quickly, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank your committee members for bringing up House Bill 66 once more. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, a lot of this language was adopted from the Senate version of the bill, and this is one of those instances where it is. And so I don't know why they have that second part in there. I mean, election fraud should be election fraud no matter what the outcome of the election is.
Thank you. Follow up. So on section 47, we talk about, and I'll read the whole sentence for context, but a person commits the crime of voter misconduct in the first degree if the person, and then the new language we're adding is, if the person votes or attempts to vote in the name of another person. And that also makes sense to me as far as voting in the name of another person. That seems to be something that should be illegal. But then also, kind of like before, we have further language that says, who is cognitively unable to express that person's vote? I'm just wondering, and maybe it's the same as the last one, but why would we want to limit that if somebody is voting or attempts to vote in the name of another person? Again, that would seem to be a bad thing. Why would we not want to make that qualify unless there's this other requirement that the person be cognitively unable to express that person's vote?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, there are times when somebody can vote on behalf of somebody else because they're disabled. However, we don't want them to be able to vote somebody else's perceived wishes if the person is not cognitive. So we don't want them to be able to do that in that circumstance, is be able to vote. For example, if I am immobile and I can't vote, but I'm able to speak and say, I've got clear conscience saying, hey, you mind filling this out for me? I can have someone fill it out for me. But if I'm disabled and I'm not cognitive, we don't want someone to be able to fill out my ballot for me.
Sure. Follow up. Okay, so I got that. I think I agree with what you're saying there. Would we not also want to make it clear that if you're voting or attempting to vote in the name of another person, that also would be prescribed unless there's some caveat to explain why that would be an okay thing? I just the concern is, and you know, there was an incident in the Valley here in the last election that kind of reflected this, I think. But if a person votes or attempts to vote in the name of another person, regardless of the cognitive side of things, wouldn't we want that also to be voter misconduct in the first degree?
And if I may, through the chair, Representative Eastman, so if someone is attempting to vote on behalf of somebody else, I think that falls underneath A1. Votes or attempts to vote in the name of another person. So I think that fault would fall into that.
Okay. All right. So it's just a different construction, different way of saying the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and if I may, through the chair, 5 is actually because we do allow people to vote on behalf of somebody else if they're disabled. Then, but we don't want them to do it
if the person happens to be disabled and not cognitive or incognitive.
Okay. Comment? I'm not sure, and maybe it's somewhere else in the bill or somewhere else in statute, but I'm not sure that the way it's written right now is would accomplish that, because it seems to me A1 would kind of capture the voting or attempting to vote in the name of another person, and there's no caveat for, you know, a situation where someone's doing a good thing and helping someone else, and then number 5 doesn't say you can do something, it just says you can't, you know, vote for somebody who isn't able to express themselves. So I'll just leave that comment out there. That's all I have. Thanks.
Okay. And thank you. And Mr. Chair, I believe that we have someone in the Department of Law online that can also, because I think there's somewhere else in statute that allows that.
Okay.
Okay. So, but having these portions in here may be a conflict.
Thank you. And Tom Flynn is online. Sorry, as I'm furiously scribbling notes. Mr. Flynn?
Yes, through the chair, this is Tom Flynn again. I think what to Representative Tuck might be referring to the special needs statute, and it would take me a minute to remember the statutory site for that, but that allows someone to assist a disabled voter with everything except the voting decision. So you couldn't make the decision on who to vote for the person you're assisting.
Thank you.
Thank you. And let the record reflect Representative Tarr joined us in person at 3:24 p.m. Further questions from the committee? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is either for Representative Tuck or for Ms. Benumiai. I'm in, I think, like Section 4, Section 5, and it has to do with the different types of ballots, because we have an absentee in-person ballot, a special needs ballot, and a question ballot. And I've been kind of scrubbing through the bill and trying to make sure that our words are consistent and that we're making sure that each one gets the attention that they need. So my question is, are these ballots handled differently when they're processed by the division?
And if I may, Mr. Chair, I would like to allow Ms. Benumiai to answer that.
Director Benumiai.
Good afternoon. This is Gail Benumiai from the Division of Elections. Through the chair, Representative Vance. The absentee in-person special needs and question ballots are ballots that are voted by voters. An envelope voter certificate is completed. The ballot is sealed inside of those envelopes, and then they are reviewed by either the absentee review board or the question review board to determine the voter's eligibility of what appears in the voter registration system compared to what they put on their ballot envelope. And then also with the special needs process to make sure that the personal representative completed their part of the envelope appropriately.
Follow up.
They all go through a review process before they're opened and counted.
Follow up.
So the absentee ballots are all reviewed. Can you define the difference between the absentee ballots and the question ballot?
Certainly, through the chair, Representative Vance. An absentee in-person ballot is a ballot that somebody would vote because they're not at the polling place on election day at one of over the 150 plus absentee or early voting locations that we have in the state. And a voter would go to that absentee voting official, present identification, be issued a ballot, complete the oath and affidavit envelope, vote their ballot, put it in the secrecy sleeve, and then, as I mentioned earlier, those ballots are returned to the division, to the appropriate regional office that has jurisdiction or the house district in which the ballot was voted, and are reviewed by the absentee review board. Same review process that's used for by-mail ballots that come back to the regional offices. A question ballot is what is voted by somebody who goes to a precinct and on election day. They're only voted on election day. and their name is not on the precinct register. So if their name's not on the precinct register or if they don't have identification, they would be required to vote a question ballot. They also then complete that voter certificate, an oath and affidavit certificate on the envelope, vote the ballot, put it in the secrecy sleeve, and seal it in that envelope, and those ballots are returned back to the division. The voter also signs, in both cases, they sign either the absentee register or the question ballot register, and those ballots go through the same review process as absentee ballots do, except by the question review board.
Follow up. So the division has five distinct types of ballots, is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, we have your polling place ballots. So those ballots don't require any review. You come in, you show identification or are personally known by the election official, you're issued your ballot and you vote it, and your verification to vote that ballot is done right there at the precinct. We have absentee by mail ballots, which require voters to submit an application before they're able to receive the by mail ballot. And then those ballots are mailed to the voters, come back to the regional offices, and go through that review process I described earlier. Then there are special needs ballots, which are the ballots that somebody who, due to age, illness, or a disability, is unable to go to the polls, and they can request somebody to deliver them a ballot. And they will vote that ballot and complete that envelope along with the person they've designated as their personal rep. Those ballots go through a review process by the absentee review board. The question ballots I described are voted at the polling place on election day, but they are not counted at the polling places. They go in those special envelopes and then are reviewed by the question review board. Then there are ballots that are voted at our early voting locations. And the difference between early voting and absentee in person is when you go to an early voting location, which are at our five regional offices, we have access to the statewide voter registration system. And a voter comes in, shows their identification. They are they're brought up in the system. And the election official asks the voter to verify their address. If it's the same as what appears in the voter registration system, then a voter certificate is printed, which they sign, and then they're issued their ballot, and they get to vote that ballot, and it goes into the precinct scanner or the ballot box. And there's no further review needed because their eligibility to cast that ballot is done right there on the spot. If their address doesn't match what is in the voter registration system, then they have to vote an absentee in person person ballot, which I described, which would go through that secondary review process.
Follow up.
Thank
you, Ms. Venumi. This is really helpful. I've been trying to wrap my brain around all these different types of ballots and how they're handled. So with HB 66, it allows for registration all the way up to election day. And if a person were to come on election day who is not registered in that district, what kind of ballot would they need in order to go through the proper review process?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, it would depend where they go to vote. So if they go to an early voting location, they would vote an absentee in person on ballot. If they come to a precinct and are not on the precinct register, either because they're not registered or they're in the wrong precinct, they would vote a question ballot. A special needs ballot is something that would be, you know, taken on behalf of the voter by an appointed personal representative to the ballot. So it's going to depend on the location of where the voting is taking place.
Follow up. Let's say, for instance, that we have a special needs person that wants to register the same day and have a special needs ballot. How would we accommodate for that?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, right now they would just vote a special needs ballot. This bill would allow them to register to vote as well, so the special needs ballot, I believe, has all the information we need on it to register somebody, but we do not use it as a registration tool at this point in time. I would have to verify that for you. They would vote in that same manner, and if same-day registration goes through, that special needs envelope would have all the required information on it as directed by this legislation in order to register that person to vote.
Okay. Thank you. I'm still processing. I have a lot more questions, but I will allow others in the committee to continue as I think about my next line of questions. Thank you, Ms. Vinumiai.
Other questions from committee? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So in section 45, through the chair, we reference the Federal Elections Commission certification of a voting machine or a vote tally system. And we specify here that the director is to consider factors relevant to using a voting machine or a voting tally system, and that they should include among those factors whether or not the Federal Election Commission has certified the voting machine or vote tally system in accordance with the Help America Vote Act of 2002. And I'm curious to know why that's only a factor in the decision of whether or not the director is going to allow that machine to be used. If it is required under federal law that the machine be certified, I would think that it would be more than just a factor to be considered. I'm curious to know your response.
Okay, if I may, I'm going to try to repeat the question back, Mr. Chair. So currently, we have in statute what's required of us for the Federal Election Commission in certifying the voting machine, so on and so forth. And then we add language to be able to have open source software technology, basically better describing and better putting sidebars on what machines that we will use and how we do that. So I think the question is I'm not sure what the question is. The question is, why do we want to do that? Or is it the question that isn't the Federal Election Commission already requiring it? Is that, if you don't mind restating, I'm sorry.
Yeah, my question is just, we've got that they're supposed to consider relevant factors, and then we say that including, whether or not the vote is certified, but I guess shouldn't that be just a disqualifier if it hasn't been certified, or if it tried to get certified and failed certification? Shouldn't that in and of itself be reason for the director not to be able to use the machine?
If I may, through the chair, there are proprietary machines that actually fall in line with the Voting Act of 2002. What we're saying now with this amendment is that in addition to that, you must be open source and not proprietary.
Okay, gotcha. All right, well, I'll have to talk to the drafter and maybe see if we can make that intent reflect, because I'm not sure that it currently reflects.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The one other area that I would like to explore and have Ms. Vinumiai comment on is in the ballot curing section, and I apologize that I don't know if this section has been changed or will be changed through the integration of the amendments that met the criteria, but the two areas that I'm interested in addressing are the pay issue that we discussed, and then on this curing, we've talked about a couple of ideas in terms of the length of time, and I know this started out as something different in the original version of the bill that also involved an affidavit. And so the part that I don't like is on line 17 of page 19, where it says the director shall immediately make a reasonable effort to contact the voter. And then it goes on to put the 48 hours in there. And so I'm hoping we can figure out how to write that a little more succinctly and clearly in terms of the process that will be followed. And so I just wanted to ask you to comment on what your ideal process would look like for ballot curing.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, I'm sorry, but I have not had the opportunity to sit down and figure out what an ideal cure process would look like. So I don't feel confident or comfortable at this time to address that question.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you. Okay. I understand that. And so I'm just wondering then, you know, thinking that the timeline is approaching here, short in terms of approaching the need to make changes and move this legislation on. So if we just think about it sort of in like a phased approach or something, so, you know, ballot is received, and then there will be someone who reviews the ballot to notice there's an issue, you know, that would lead to the ballot needing to be identified as a ballot to be cured. So at some point, you know, I would say there's the receiving of the ballot, there's the sorting of a ballot because it's, you know, picked, culled from the rest and sorted into its own pile of a ballot that needs to be cured. And then, you know, in terms of a communication process, I guess that would be next. And then is there anything else we need to be thinking about in terms of, you know, you receive the ballot, it's sorted, and then whatever process we think is the best and you know, the right amount of time. I think we were talking the other day, instead of the 2 days, something more like 5 days. Does that sort of sound like it's covered?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, I kind of see where you're going now, so excuse me. The way I would envision it working is as ballots come in and are logged by staff and identified to have a deficiency, such as no signature, because it's my understanding in the bill, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the signature verification isn't done until the absentee review board actually reviews the ballot. And that comes at a much later time than after when the ballot is received. So I do need to take some time to study this section and maybe could get back to the committee with somewhat of a proposal. But I know that we would, as soon as the deficiency is identified, then we would have staff designated to handle the cure process, developing the forms, figuring out a method of contact with the voter, et cetera.
Mr. Chairman, and to the director, that would be super helpful because, you know, I think the caution here with any of these changes is we don't want to create a situation where somehow now you're in violation of the law, even if our efforts were well-intentioned. And if you do have the time among the other responsibilities you have to think a little bit about that, that would be very informative for me and I hope for others.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, I also wonder if Tom from the Department of Law might have some ideas about the terms reasonable effort. I don't know if he has any suggestions as to what might make that not quite so uncertain, I guess, so to speak.
Yeah, and we can go to Mr. Flynn here in a second. And I mean, just a comment, I feel like this is a really tricky tension just in terms of hours of the day. And sometimes I wish sort of had a Hermione Granger time changer to help make things a little bit easier because DOE is sort of administering a once in a generation special election that's like, I can imagine, unbelievably administratively intensive, and there are election omnibus bills going through both chambers that are, you know, for real. So a lot of empathy, Director Funumiai, for everything that you're juggling, and at the same time, you know, the extent to which we can get a sense of what makes sense from an administrative perspective and a vision, and it'll be helpful to inform the policy that we craft. So Mr. Flynn, do you have any comments on the subject?
Thank you, Chair Kreis-Thompson, to Representative Tarr. So one thing I'll add that perhaps would be helpful thinking about the timeline here is if you really look at the additions to on page 19 that deadline of 48 hours to no later than 2 days after Election Day, that only applies to notice by mail or email. And there are, of course, other sorts of notices that the division could send, including the ballot tracking software or app or whatever it ends up being. That would also notify a voter that they should go in and cure their ballot. And there are, in some cases, the division might have a phone number or another way to contact a voter. So the real deadline to cure remains, I believe it's 14 days after the election. Yeah, on page 20, it's 14 days. So the 48 hours to 2 to 5 days, that's only for mail and email. There's other sorts of notice. And I think it would be, if this were to be enacted as it is written here, the division would certainly attempt to notify someone as soon as possible and in every way possible that they had to come in and cure their ballot to give them the maximum amount of time to come in and do that.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and then if the voter has provided a telephone number, of course, they can do that too, just down to the bottom of that paragraph. But also I believe we have Hillary Hall online with the Vote at Home Institute that may be able to share how others may do it.
Absolutely. Ms. Hall, if you're with us, can you speak to the subject?
Can you hear me?
Hear you.
Yes, to represent. Yes, thank you, Chair. I'm through the chair. This is Hillary Hall from the National Voter at Home Institute, and everything that's being said is spot on with what other states do. It is that trying to get the notice out within 48 hours is especially important after the election, so that people can cure their signature as soon as possible. And that, I think the other piece that makes this a really well thought through bill is the use of ballot tracking. Many of the laws were written before ballot tracking and notification systems existed. And so with that, that speeds up the process dramatically. And then I think the important part also is to make sure that funds are dedicated to promote the use of signing up and enrolling the voters in that process as they sign up to vote by mail.
Any follow-up, Representative Tarr?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so in terms of the, and this would be for Ms. Hall, just appreciate any additional insight. So in terms of what you know from other states, it's sort of like a, use every opportunity kind of contact. So, that seems very consistent with what you've seen in other states and the timelines as well.
Through the chair, again, Hillary Hall. Yes, that's what we've seen. And the focus is for the election office to prioritize and make the effort within that time period. And that's where I would defer to the director of elections is that doable for them? But it's more about just getting the message out. And then, as we know, it may take longer for it actually to reach the voter. But that's why it's trying to, find that sweet spot of how long with everything that's going on to process that information and get it out with the other duties that also have to be taken into account.
Representative Vance, new line of questioning?
Yes, I do. And luckily it's along the same area. It's been one that I've been looking at as well, and I'm asking more questions. Ms. Finney, may I, through the chair, does the state currently use a ballot tracking system with our absentee ballots?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, the state has deployed ballot tracks, so that system is up and running. We had planned to use it for the August primary election, and then with the special primary election being conducted all by mail, we ramped up the deployment time, and so that system is out there live right now.
Follow up. So this will be the first time that the division is using ballot tracks?
Through the chair, that's correct. The division did have its own home-built My Voter portal, which did do similar things that ballot tracks does.
Follow up. Thank you. If I understand, you're probably just now getting familiar with ballot tracks, and I'll go look at it myself, but just for the sake of the committee, do you know if Ballot Tracks has the capacity to provide for the division to provide the voter a notification of a deficiency in ballot through that system?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, yes, Gail from the division, I have been told that Ballot Tracks does have that capability. It's just a matter of the information that's uploaded into that system. And so it would have that capability if the cure process does become a law.
Wonderful. I think that may alleviate some of our concerns. And if you have any insight on how that could be worded in this bill to help not restrict but utilize that program would be helpful to us, I think, as we work through this. Because as Representative Tarr mentioned, we don't want to be so restricted that you can't do your job, but we also want to make sure that the public sees that there's clear guidelines so that they can have their confidence. And I think this ballot tracking system may just be what a lot of us have been looking for. The second follow-up question has to do with this. This specifically is talking about absentee ballots. Do you know if the other types of ballots, besides the ones that people go in and actually put into the ballot, you know, tabulator, could they also be utilized? Could we utilize this ballot tracking system with ballots besides just the absentee?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I am not certain about that. I don't think that's a possibility without having some kind of electronic poll book, perhaps. I did want to go back, if you don't mind, that the bill does say you could notify the voter of a deficiency by telephone call or text message. And enrolling in Ballot Tracks, those are some of your options. You can either get an email from them, you can get a phone call, or you can be notified by text message. But I don't have that answer, and I don't know if Ms. Hall has any information on that.
Ms. Hall?
Thank you, Hillary Hall, National Vote at Home Institute. Through the chair, just want to make sure I understand your question correctly. This is talking about the emergency ballots and the other types of ballots that you spoke of earlier, and making sure that as those are processed, people know about how they are finally their final disposition as to whether they were accepted or not. Is that correct?
Yes.
I think it depends on how that information is tracked, and I think that you're working with one of the top companies, Ballot Tracks, and that's something that they are always exploring how to make better use of that. I think, you know, to the point of state election director, it's are those in an electronic poll book and are they in a data file? And if there's a data file, then there's most likely a way that you can incorporate that. It could also be additional cost, though, because it's designed currently for absentee ballots in the format that they're already processed in.
One more follow-up. This is for Representative Tuck. I know that the special needs ballots and those other ballots have been of particular interest to you to make sure that they have, that people have access to them. If this is something that we could investigate, that people who vote by special needs or these other means would be able to track their ballot as well, I think that would be something of interest to our voters, because it just seems like such a great system to know. It might ease some anxiety that may be present, and I think that would be worthwhile pursuing.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just on this same little section, and thank you for letting me go back to it, because I just wanted to think about it and sort of process it here. And I guess where I've landed is, you know, that first part doesn't really even need to be in there, because, you know, the text that ends on line 17 or the ballot is rejected, you know, you could just go down to the next sentence and have, I think, take that other information out of there, so it would be more clearly delineated that there's sort of the timeline for the mail communication, and then, you know, maybe what could be added then is a timeline, so that it's more clear what's being described here, sort of two different processes. So the one is, you know, what happens within 48 hours about the mail, and then, you know, if the voters provided the telephone number, The director shall attempt to notify the voter of the deficiency by telephone call or text message to the voter's telephone number. You know, I think we could add something like daily there or something like that, right? Because there is that other time frame. So that's just one sort of thought I'm considering to take out the other language that I think sort of is problematic, is then just, you know, that would leave it just a sort of two-step process, or, you know, two-part process there of, you know, one that's the mail communication, the other that's the electronic. But I did want to double check, Director Fanumi, there was another version that included an affidavit. Do you think that's necessary, or is there sort of a pro-con approach to using an affidavit for this ballot curing process?
Through the chair, Gail Fanumi, Representative Tarr, I don't know if an affidavit is necessary. I don't know what the municipality of Anchorage uses for signature cures. If it's just a form they sign, maybe Ms. Hall has more experience in that, to see if that is, you know, the best practices. Perhaps she could comment on that.
Ms. Hall.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm sorry. Can you rephrase that question? I apologize. I wasn't quite following.
Thank you. And through the chair, to Ms. Hall, there are a few different versions of election-related bills under consideration right now, and different sort of models for ballot curing. In one of them, there was an affidavit used, and I just wonder if you think that's you know, an item that works well in this process, or that we should consider in the version here that doesn't have that.
That is a quite standard practice to use an affidavit, and there's another technology, and BallotTrax is actually partnering with them, and it's called Text-to-Cure. So it also allows, not only is there a physical form that can be emailed to someone, but it's also a form where you can use text and notify if someone has a deficiency, and they can actually use the affidavit and provide updated ID through their phone. So that's another option that is used in many of the states that have been having permanent mail and cure processes for a longer period of time.
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So I see in section 36 that we are to, the statute would read, not less than 10 days preceding the day of the election, the election supervisor in the presence and with the assistance of the district absentee ballot counting board shall begin to review all voter certificates and envelopes of absentee ballots received by that date. And I want to pose a concern, ask for your response through the chair, of course. Now, if it's 10 days before the election, that would be probably the busiest time for most campaigns of the year. And I imagine there'll be the fewest number of volunteers from a campaign available to go and be part of, you know, observing this process. I understand they do, each candidate and campaign have the right to have an observer to observe this process, but if we're starting to count them before the election, particularly in the 10 days before the election, I'm just wondering if, especially for our smaller campaigns, that there's really not any way practically for them to be able to observe that process.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, this is given because we expect more people to be voting by mail. This last election where we had so many people voting by mail, and we had such a high voter turnout, we didn't have election results. But all within statutory framework, we did have election results, but the public was not used to waiting so long to get those results. We're trying to allow more time for the Division of Elections to be able to start processing by starting a little bit earlier. And so earlier by, I think, 3 days. Campaigns, those who want to observe, those who want to participate, would probably have to start 3 days earlier. I've seen some great participation, having to review ballots myself, my campaign reviewing ballots and overseeing and watching the Division of Elections. Great participation. I don't expect that to die off. As a matter of fact, if you look at how we have this structure, we're trying to get more participation rather than less participation.
Thank you.
And if I may point out that this is this actually is combining what the governor has in his bill right now, section 19.
Thank you. So I'm looking at section 38. And section 38 deals also with absentee ballots. And it provides that a determination needs to be made whether the absentee voter is qualified to vote at the election, whether the signature on the certificate is consistent with the voter's signature in voter registration records. And I'd like to know a little bit more about how we anticipate that process will take place. Someone's going to have to make that determination. I understand from previous testimony that some type of software is anticipated to be used. For the record, I want to share there's a concern among some members of the public that in other states, these types of signature verification have been less than stellar. And I know particularly in Nevada, there was a reporter who got with about a dozen voters, I think 10 in fact, and encouraged them to write using their own handwriting really bad signatures just to see if they would get kicked back. All the signatures that were submitted were really, really obviously not matching whatever it was that Nevada elections had on file. And yet 9 out of the 10 that were submitted all were approved. And it was also said that the software that they're using allows you to adjust the strictness of matching. And it was set on the lowest setting. And of course, if it's on the lowest setting, then it doesn't really do much. I would hope that that's not the direction we're headed, but can you give us some more details on how you would anticipate that that process would be employed?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, we did consult with Lieutenant Governor Meyer as well as Senator Schauer. This is actually Senator Schauer's, part of Senator Schauer's bill. Oh, I'm sorry, it was the governor's bill on this one, section 20. And so in the three of us getting together and discussing this, it does look like that we'll have to have some more signature verification machines. I think maybe up to 5 for the load that we may have with our voting tendencies, and about $750,000 per machine. In regards to how those machines are set, it's unfortunate Nevada may have done a pretty light load on that. But in the bill also, we also have training people to recognize signatures as well. And so this is a way of basically, and part of that elections integrity part is making sure that we have as many opportunities to verify that signature as much as possible as we look at these different ways that people are going to be voting. So with that being said, there was good testimony that we had from Patty McGuire from the state of Washington that discussed a lot of that and how they maintain their own elections integrity. Unfortunately, he's not here today, but I'd be more than happy to invite him back to be available for a question down the road.
Thank you. Follow up. It's going on to from section 38 to section 39. So 39, we're changing the language from an absentee ballot may not be counted, and we're saying in place an absentee ballot may be rejected. Now, the former language was very prescriptive. It was either, you know, if it matches these criteria, it must be not counted. I'm wondering, how is this word may going to be interpreted? So we have these circumstances where an absentee ballot may be rejected. Are we giving discretion to the division or to some individual on, well, if these things happen and they choose to, they can reject it, or they have the discretion to not reject it? That seems a lot more subjective than the previous language.
If I may, through the chair, Representative, actually, Mr. Chairman, I probably would like to let our Department of Law discuss that. I mean, sorry, our Division of Legal answer that question for us.
Mr. Klein. Are you with us, Mr. Klein? You might be on mute if you are, but it's possible that well, Mr. Klein shown is being online, but we could circle back in a little bit.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, it's really basically the form of how they wanted to clarify and make the changes so it reads well. I don't think it's changing, but when you look at all the other different provisions going down, it's just so it reads well. And if I may, Mr. Chair, when we look at, and I got to make sure I understood properly, but Representative Tarr was talking about on page 19, lines 13 roughly down to 17, eliminating that. Was that correct, Representative Tarr, that it may not be necessary?
Mr. Chairman, is okay to respond. Through the chair, I was thinking it may just be, you know, lines 17, 18, 19, just take that out and then just have the language that's in that section just more clearly spell out one process for contact by mail and then the other process that's contact, you know, by telephone or text message, and then just simplify that so it's sort of just clear that there's like two processes for communication and leave it at that.
Sure, and if I may, through the chair, when we take out those lines, you're actually going to be taking out these provisions. You're not taking out these provisions. These provisions are going to stay here in Section 39. But you're basically saying it's what we have right now in 15-20-222, the procedure for curing uncounted ballots. It's only for these conditions. And so by taking that section out, this section right here, I guess it could be for any condition rather than just these conditions.
Through the chair to Representative Tuck, I'm saying on line 17 it'd be after the number 5.
Oh,
so you'd leave all the conditions in there and then just go into, you know, the process by which the director would contact. So again, just spell out the one that would be the mail contact and the other that would be, you know, the telephone call or text message, and that way it would leave no gray area ambiguity around what the timeline was and how they should be contacted.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the clarification. I appreciate that. Well, and then also, Mr. Chair, I don't know, while we're waiting for Mr. Klein, possibly Ms. Hall would be able to answer the question from Representative Eastman. Ms. Klein might be able to answer that if we can't get a hold of Tom.
Yeah, and I think yes, sounds like Mr. Klein is perhaps back with us. Mr. Klein, do you copy?
To the chair, yes, this is Noah Klein with Legislative Legal Services. Sorry about that. I had a technical difficulty.
Oh, no problem. I believe the question may have been from Representative Eastman.
Yes. So my question deals with the word may and how that is going to be interpreted. Is may, does that allow for discretion, or is that just a nice way of saying must?
Through the chair, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services, for the record, to Representative Eastman. The word may there, I think the intent is to identify that some of these ballots will not be rejected at the end of the day because they could be cured. But I do see the point that you're making, Representative Eastman. If it's the will of the committee, I could draft something directing that an absentee ballot shall be rejected unless it's cured or something along those lines. But historically, before curing existed, like Representative Eastman, like you said, this said an absentee ballot may not be counted because there was no way that a ballot could be counted if it failed to meet these following criteria. Whereas if the bill is adopted, then there would be the opportunity to cure some absentee ballots that didn't meet these criteria.
Thank you. Follow up. To the sponsor again. So same section, page 16, line 30. That line ends with the word or. And as I'm reading it, I'm trying to figure out if or is what we're trying to say or if we should be saying and. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that. And I can also throw the question of the legal significance, if any, to the drafter.
Good afternoon, Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck through the chair. So this is intended to try to address a couple of issues. One, not all mail is postmarked. And it also allows the use of the tracking barcode that is another part of the bill. So it is not postmarked on or before the date of the election or does not have a United States Postal Service tracking barcode sufficient to verify that the ballot was mailed on or before the day of the election. So what we are trying to do is to basically count all of the ballots that are legally cast on or before election day with the understanding that we're using this new barcode system or some of the new technology that is out there right now.
Thank you. And follow-up? And if we were giving instructions on to the division to, you know, consider a ballot, I think I would use the word or. I would say, hey, either it's eligible under option A or option B. Either way, you accept it. But I think the language that we're referencing in that statute is talking about rejecting the ballot. So maybe and would be more appropriate.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, if we put and in there, then it has to be both of those before it can be rejected. Here we have or, it can be this or that as a reason to reject. So that's a policy call if you want to make it so that it's both of those items. We can.
Follow up. New line of questioning, and I don't want to hog the microphone, but
let's go to Rep.
Go ahead,
and we'll rotate back. Rep.
Thank you through the chair to the bill sponsor. Just wondering as we go, to more mail-in ballots through the absentee system, and we have a volume of ballots that are received before the actual day of in-person voting. Do we have adequate controls to prevent kind of the results of that earlier voting from leaking out and in some way inhibiting turnout on election day?
I'm going to repeat the question, make sure I understand through the chair. So what we have is, so you're saying that once we start looking at the ballots, start counting the ballots, how do we prevent that from going out to the public or leaking out? I would like to ask Ms. Benumiai that question, because I think some ballots are already counted ahead of time for those that vote early. Those are already pre-counted, so we can find out what the existing security measures are.
Director Benumiai.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, current statute doesn't allow the counting of ballots to take place until election day. The review can take place ahead of time, but they're not counted and results released until after the polls close.
Follow up.
Thank
you for that. And with this legislation that we're considering now, is there anything in here that would change that to where we're counting them to get kind of ahead of the game, so to speak?
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, I don't believe so. I think what happened in that one section, 1520-201A, I don't know what section it is in the bill, actually. That just allows the boards to come in earlier to start reviewing ballots earlier. So there will be more ballots that will be deemed eligible to be counted on election night.
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Mason.
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck through the chair. So everybody's right, but there is one more thing. The bill, as it's currently written, does allow the absentee ballots count to begin before election day. That was a call that was made during the drafting process because there was such angst about that the absentee ballot totals were not available on election day. So if you go to page 15, section 37, counting of absentee ballots that have been reviewed, and we've already discussed the review, that's in section 36, shall begin not fewer than 7 days preceding the day of the election at places designated by the election supervisor, shall continue till all the absentee ballots reviewed and eligible for counting have been counted. Counting team shall report the first count of the absentee ballots to the district absentee ballot counting board not later than 8 p.m. local time on the day of the election. So the count will go out when the first count goes out on election day, but they will be able to actually count them. Now, you're right, that will entail some security measures by the Department, Division of Elections. They will have to make sure that that is secure, and we'll leave that up to the professionals to do.
Follow up on that.
Follow up.
Ms. Fanume, or through the chair, do you think that is there anything that would need to be done legislatively to make clear what you would need to do to assure that that information was secure until the proper time to release that information?
Gail Fidumi from the Division of Elections, through the chair of the Coffin. I don't believe so. I mean, the ballots would be scanned by the regional counting board after they have gone through the review process by the absentee review board and opened and deemed eligible for counting, but the results would not be uploaded until after the polls close, and the upload takes place by the regional election supervisor.
Follow-up. Thank you for that. What informs my line of questioning, and I forget which national election it was, but essentially the press started declaring a winner before the West Coast had fully voted, and it was seen that it may have tipped things because, you know, why go vote if it's a done deal? And so I just want to be assured that our intent and the processes that will be in place will prevent that from happening in a different form where, you know, the results, the early results are leaked out and people are somehow suppressed from going on election day. Thank you for the information you provided on that. I appreciate it.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Follow up on that through the chair. Now, when those absentee ballots are being counted, do campaigns and candidates and political parties have the right to observe that process while that count is taking place?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, there is an opportunity for people to observe that process from a distance, yes.
Follow up. And so then are we going to be requiring observers to sign some kind of confidentiality document that, you know, whatever they're observing during the vote counting process, they're not going to communicate to someone outside that room until a certain date or time?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the ballots will not be election quote will not be ended on that tabulator until the polls close. That nobody will know what the results are until the I don't know what the exact right term is because I don't use the scanners myself, but until the counting has concluded on that machine, there are no reports printed. And so no one would see reports until after the supervisor has loaded that information into the main system.
Follow up. Yes, I understand someone's not going to be able to, you know, see a printout of the vote totals, but observers are going to be able to observe what is marked on ballots. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I do not believe that observers get that close to where the ballots are actually going through the scanners.
Follow up.
Okay, I'm a little confused. So what's the point of observing a ballot counting process if the observer is not permitted to be close enough to see what's actually on the ballot?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, what has happened in the past is that the board has, people have watched the envelopes come out sealed from the secure ballot room, that the regional counting board are the only people that open that envelope and touch those ballots, and put them through the units, and they watch them go through the machines. And they are there in case, you know, any issues come up. They are told what's happening. But nobody has access or touches those ballots except Division of Election employees or the counting boards.
Follow up. It strikes me if observers aren't allowed to observe ballots and what's on them, maybe we should call them something other than observers.
That's a comment, so I'm going to comment. And I think the point is, it's sort of chasing a ghost here. These like concerns about what the problem is that I think your question presupposes we're trying to solve, Representative Eastman. I mean, as somebody who's gone through a recount, because my first election was sufficiently close, and sat in the room and watched ballots be counted, there was nothing nefarious. There's nothing to be concerned about. I thought DOE comported themselves with the utmost professionalism and competence. And so if there's a problem that you're trying to solve, state the problem, and we can pursue that with the Division of Elections.
So follow up to that. I think one of the main reasons for some aspects of the bill is to increase the confidence the public has in the processes, and that they're, as you say, done correctly. And an important part of that, and my understanding, has always been both candidates or parties, you know, as the case may be, if there's two candidates, they both have someone to be able to observe that, you know, what is being done, how the ballot's being handled, how they're being counted is, in fact, you know, accurate. So it subverts that purpose if ahead of time. I mean, it might solve other purposes, but it subverts that purpose ahead of time if we're going to say that those who are observing are going to be kept far away or far enough away from that process to where they won't actually be able to come away from that process with any sufficient confidence one way or the other. All they'll say is, you know, well, I saw some things, and that's it. I mean, what they won't be able to answer the question, well, did the process run the way it should? Was the count, you know, accurate?
So it sounds like, Representative Eastman, what you're proposing is that observers maintain a literal tally, perhaps by hand, of the number of ballots they're getting run through the scanner on election night, and that's the way that they ensure the integrity of the election result?
You know, I don't know if a tally is necessary, but to be able to see that, you know, for example, if there's something on a ballot, to be able to see if, oh gosh, all the ballots look exactly the same, you know, or, you know, gosh, you know, my candidate's name was missing from the ballot, or any number of things which you wouldn't know what the issue is unless you're there and you're seeing it and you're like, wow, that's odd, you know. But if you aren't able to actually see it, you wouldn't know that anything's odd, because you wouldn't know.
Yeah, you'd think that if candidates' names were missing from the ballot, you'd hear that from voters on election day. But I think we can move on from these scenarios. Other lines of questioning? Representative Tart.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a comment, if I might, briefly. And I think, you know, to address some of the questions that Representative Eastman was just asking, I mean, part of how we make sure the public has confidence is, in my opinion, you know, what was shared with your comments, Mr. Chairman. You know, we know that the individuals, you know, are professionals that are competent, that are committed to following the law, that, you know, make sure people are doing the same and when they do that work. So, I mean, I think we, part of what that's not in the legislation, but part of what we have a responsibility to do is, you know, make sure we share that information with our constituents. And I just wanted to get that on the record, that I think outside of passing legislation, there's a responsibility in our role as public officials to, you know, dispel any mistruths or myths and, you know, make sure that people know that we do have good people doing these jobs. And thank you again to the director for the hard work they're doing. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Tucker.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we try to model as much as we can with the state of Colorado. They really do have a process. And I think when they do their ballot counting, I mean, part of the observation is a lot of that's videotaped. You can watch it. But I know from my own personal experience, because my first election, too, came down to those last counts. I was able to see everything that was going on right there. We were roped off. I kind of remember in my head that there might have been plexiglass, but we can see all the activities that are taking place. But with that, I would see if Ms. Hall can share with us about observations as well.
Ms. Hall, any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is Hillary Hall, National Vote at Home Institute, through the chair, in response to Representative Eastman's comments. I think first it's important to realize that scanning and tabulating are two different things, and that's what the Director of Elections was addressing. You would be scanning ballots ahead of time, but tabulation would not actually occur until before the results are posted. And then in addition to that, the speed at which ballots go through is not a speed where you can watch every ballot. And most of the systems also have a screen that's showing those ballots be processed, right? So it's a scanner. You put a stack of ballots on the scanner, and the ballots run through. And so the point of observers that we've had in Colorado is to see, you know, does that come from a sealed ballot box, the chain of custody, what's the process going through there, and to show that the batch got run through, and that proper record keeping is being collected so that if there are any questions. And then as to whether the results are accurate, you also are addressing that because you've added the risk-limiting audit to this bill, and that's the way to verify and assure that all the ballots were proper and that the ballot tallies were accurate as well. So I feel like the bill that's as it's been written is really addressing both ends of those things and is adding additional transparency by allowing more observers to see the process.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, involved for the chair. And I guess this question is more for the division, but the equipment that we are going to be using in elections here in Alaska, will it have the type of screen that was just described?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman. The adjudication screens are not used during the ballot counting process that Ms. Hall described.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Clayman, did you have a question?
Not so much a question. I think the discussion is interesting, but I think we're kind of getting into smaller and smaller and narrower issues. And I recognize we don't have amendments up on this bill yet, and the appropriate time to take up these issue seems to be at amendments, and I know we have other matters on our agenda, so I would urge us possibly, as you like to say, to put a pin in this and go on to the next topic.
That is, that council is noted. Representative Tuck?
Just one final comment, if we were to do that, Mr. Chair, and that is to point out that I want to thank Ms. Vanumiai for being quick responding to the questions that were asked in the last meeting. One, to deal with the maintenance of our list, the process that's there. This is very good. And then also dealing with the wages of our poll workers. So I just want to make sure everybody got those documents and point them out.
Thank you, Representative Tuck. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. In Section 40, where you say an election official may not determine that the signature on a voter's return envelope does not match the signature stored in the voter's registration record solely based on substitution of initials or use of a common nickname. And I wonder what is the intent with that provision?
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck, through the chair. My mother and my ex-wife call me Michael, and that is my given name, but I never sign Michael. I sign Mike. So that's a common nickname. My best friend, his name is Christopher, but no one calls him Christopher. Everybody calls him CB. So people use nicknames, and so it's basically to allow people to be who they are and still have their vote count.
I guess I would assume if the individual is going to use that common nickname, you know, to sign when they're going to vote or when they're filling out their envelope, is that what has to match what the division has on file? Or are we saying that, you know, if they have a different signature on file, but they choose to use their initials or a common nickname, you know, for the election, that we're not going to use that against them, even though it doesn't match.
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck, through the chair. I would anticipate and I would hope that we would give the Division of Elections the flexibility to be able to, if on my driver's license, I think I probably have Michael Mason on there. And if I sign Mike Mason, that they can compare the two and determine that I am who I am. And then if not, I have the cure process that is available to me. So I would hope that the Division of Elections would have the flexibility to basically deal with that issue.
I might ask Ms. Hall, who's in Colorado, how that works in practice in Colorado or other states that use signature verification. Ms. Hall?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, this is Hillary Hall, National Vote at Home. Representative Eastman, yes, it's a common practice to allow for nicknames or initials because the last name is also there, and it's taking when you do signature verification, you're looking at many factors, and what you need is enough of the signature to be there that matches. And so the last name often has enough of that in, and then you look at the first name to make sure that it's a version of a common nickname, right? Peg for Margaret, or like Mike for Michael, like they're saying, and that is enough. Even with, you know, we've worked with signature documentation experts in our police force, and they too have trained us on how to look through that. And again, you have training in your program. So it's a great practice because it really enables the voter. They don't remember what did they sign at the time of they registered. Many of them signed that form many years ago. And so it allows for both security and accuracy, but also allows most voter participation.
Well, so my initials are, you know, DE. If I was just to sign DE and not, you know, fill out my full last name, would that be rejected? Or would it be your intent that would be rejected because it wasn't, you know, full enough signature for verification?
I don't think that's a question for Mr. Mitz. Is that a question for Ms. Hall?
For the sponsor.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, thank you for that question. Unless it's obvious that is the person, I wouldn't want to limit it to just initials only. But if they, you know, like for my mom's name is Dolores Marta Tuck. She doesn't go by Dolores. She goes by Marta. So she writes D Marta Tuck. And so the D would be appropriate. Doing DMT, I would think that we would probably have to ballot cure that one.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I go to my questions, just a comment. The bill does provide that it's going to compare the signature that is given to the division on file. So if the person has a consistent way of signing that's, for instance, DE, and it matches, then that would be fine. It's just when a change occurs that the cure that does not match the nuances of that signature that I'm assuming that's when the cure would be needed. And I'm relieved that we are pursuing the curing process because I have constituents who have had similar names and said, hey, no, I know I voted, and they were notified too late that their ballot was absolutely rejected. So being able to cure that, no, I really am the person who voted and can make that simple correction, I think is prudent. But the line of questioning that I have is regard to the early voting stations and the division having the need to change a voting location. This came up during the pandemic, and it created a lot of consternation with voters of just needing to know where to vote. And if I could have Ms. Fanumiai talk about what the protocol currently is when there needs to be a change in voting location and that time frame, because I know that that occurred in multiple areas across the state, most notably in Anchorage, that ended up flipping a House seat, but also in my area, there is a need to change a voting location and people didn't feel notified. So before I go into the specifics of the bill, Ms. Benumiai, would you talk about what the protocol is now of what the division, the steps the division takes if a voting location needs to be changed?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, are you talking about Section 23 of the bill?
I believe so. Let me scroll my pages. Yes, Section 23 on page 11.
So Section 23 of the bill is specifically about our absentee/early voting locations. And there really is not a procedure in place about that. We are supposed to provide notice of where those locations are, and we put that on our website. But things happen when they have to change, and sometimes we don't have a whole lot of notice. A building becomes unavailable. The building owner decides they no longer want to have people voting there. So when we make those changes, we identify it on our website, and we usually highlight it or put the word new next to it so people know that it's a new location. There is a different process in place for changing polling places that's already outlined in statute.
Follow up. So when you change polling location, what kind of agreement do you have with a building owner with a facility when you want to use that specific location as a polling location?
Through the chairperson, Vance, they're sent a polling place agreement form or that they sign, and then they have given us permission to use their facility. But then sometimes things happen, like there's no power. The pipes froze. Sometimes the building, unfortunately, is locked. It doesn't remain open, and so we have emergency needs to change a polling place on short notice.
Follow up. Do you find that the Section 23 concerning early voting stations is consistent with the current statutes for polling locations, or is it different?
Through the chairperson, Vance, it appears to be somewhat different. I'm trying to find the statute that talks about our requirements for when polling places are changed. I'm not able to put my finger on it right this moment. So it's not as detailed as a polling place change. A polling place change, I know, requires a reasonable effort if time permits to, it's 15, Alaska Statute 1510090, whenever possible, send written notice of the change, publication in the newspaper, posting notices in areas on the old polling place location, and remember polling places are those locations used on election day only, and then posters around, posting on our internet, providing notice if it's appropriate to other entities like clerks, councils, tribal groups, native villages, et cetera.
Follow up. Ms. Numiai, has there been any litigation or, other judgments made concerning the change of polling vote locations that the committee may need to be aware of as we consider policy directives on the polling locations and the early voting stations?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I'm not aware of any litigation related to early voting locations or absentee in-person stations. I think you referenced a House race in the 2020 general election, in which there was an emergency change on the day before the election, I believe it was, and I think that was litigated. I don't have the details on that, and Mr. Flynn had to leave this hearing to attend another one, so I don't have that information readily available.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's something that I would be interested in us clarifying. both what we have directly in the bill and the polling locations. What I'm interested in is preserving the rights of the property owners, but also ensuring that the public knows that their voting location is going to be consistent, because I think a lot of people just chose not to vote because they didn't know where to go. And I know that we're wanting to encourage more people to vote. And so I'd like to pursue what that should look like in this without creating a whole nother bill. Thank you.
Noted. Representative Tuck, do you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did address this in a previous version of this bill. I was just looking for it and realized I couldn't find it, because all we're doing right now is early voting. But back in the 2016 election, there was a lot of polling places that were relocated, which Representative Vance correctly pointed out that people were, it's kind of a voter suppression method, because people did not turn out to vote because they could not find their polling locations. And so the intent in a previous version was, once we set up a polling location, that polling location remains for the next 10 years until redistricting happens again, to prevent that confusion from happening. It seems like it's no longer in this version of the CS, but that was a previous version that we had. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we could have, as we deliberate this, if we could have Department of Law's insight, because this comes into the property owners' rights. I know a lot of the polling locations are schools, or in my district it was firehouses, churches, and that there were sudden changes during the pandemic for obvious reasons, but then people going where else, some of my more rural communities, there were limited options and they had to go all the way into Saldana, from Kisilov to Saldana, to vote. And so I want to make sure that as we consider this, that Department of Law gives us any insight onto our limitations for property owners and different facilities that may be government owned, but it kind of crosses jurisdiction with boroughs and things like that.
And if I may comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so with fortunately, I don't have language here, but the language we had at one time was basically saying that, you can't lock in a property owner to say, hey, I'm going to be here for the next 10 years for you. But what it did do is, when it does change, is proper notification to the voter and ample notification. And then also, if there's a fire or something like that, still allow that. But the division itself cannot make a determination unilaterally to change that location unless there was a list of reasons. And one of those is that the property owner just simply didn't want us to have it there anymore.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Now, how does the bill handle a situation where you show up to that polling place to vote, and through an error on their part of the division, you're not registered with that particular precinct? Like, you live there, it's where you should be going, but they have you listed in a different precinct. Are you still able to vote for the person you were supposed to be able to vote for?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I'm glad you're asking that question, because that's one of the benefits of some same-day voter registration, is that if you happen not to be on the voter roll of that precinct that you appeared at, you can actually fill it out right then and there. And then you'll be voting a question ballot, and then they can look to see to allow you to vote all the way down to that precinct based on the information that you provided. As a matter of fact, I believe in the previous committee, you pointed that out, that it's not good for somebody to show up to a precinct where they've been voting, continually, but then they ended up moving, they show up to that other precinct. They still should be able to vote all the way down to that House candidate, but what we don't want to do is turn people away and say, no, you need to go back to that district that you're registered in, even though you haven't been living there for the last 2 years. You need to go back to that other district and vote over there, because you're voting for someone who is not going to be your representative. And so I appreciate the comment and the question.
Thank you, Paul.
Well,
and how does your bill handle a situation where they may not be anticipating that you're going to show up to that precinct, and so they don't have the appropriate ballot for you, and you want to vote all the way down, but the ballot they have is not going to match your House candidate, for example, that you're trying to vote for?
So I'm going to rephrase that question on that scenario to make sure I got it right. So somebody shows up to a precinct where they no longer vote in that precinct because they don't live in that precinct anymore. Let's just say district, because precinct really doesn't matter that much. Let's say district. Well, unfortunately, they're not going to be able to vote for their House member in that scenario, because the polling places only have the ballots that apply to that given area. So they would only be able to vote down to probably the Senate race if they still live in the same Senate district.
Sure. Oh, appreciate that. Follow up. In Section 11 of the bill, you have a provision to cancel your voter registration at the polling place. And I'm curious, two parts. One, why is it important to give a voter a chance to cancel their registration at the polling place? And the second is, if they're voting, since it's at the polling place, if they're voting, is canceling the registration going to impact the vote that they just cast?
Through the chair, thank you for that question, Representative Eastman. That was mostly in the Senate version, in Section 9 of Senate Bill 39. And the thinking behind that is we want to keep our voter rolls as clean as possible. And if somebody knows that they're going to be moving in the next couple of months and this is the last time of voting in that area, they can go ahead and help the Division of Elections clean those rolls because, you know, they're off to another state or to another area.
Okay. So it wouldn't impact their...
No, oh, I'm sorry. And follow up for that, for the chair. No, it would not impact their existing vote.
Thank you.
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck, through the chair. Just to clarify, Section 11, the director shall develop a process to allow a voter to cancel voter registration in person before an election official or electronically. So you do have some flexibility. You don't have to do it like in just one location. There's multiple locations.
Thank you. Follow up. In Section 13, we've got a new section, and we make clear that a poll watcher must be a United States citizen. Is that a federal requirement, or is that a decision that you've made? And I'm wondering why we would say, if it's not a federal requirement, why we would say that someone had to be a United States citizen as opposed to, say, an Alaska resident. Obviously, someone from Arizona is a United States citizen, so I guess they could watch, whereas maybe someone who's not a citizen but is an Alaska resident, you know, maybe they want to watch and we're saying they can't.
I'm glad you asked this question because, through the chair, because I had a hard time with this too. It's like, but then when you come down to it, you know, someone observing, does it matter where they reside on whether they can observe or not? But no, I had that same question because every time we've introduced this bill, that section, being a U.S. citizen, has always been taken out. And so I appreciate that. I kind of just warmed up to the idea that I guess you really don't need to be a citizen to be able to observe and watch. You just need to be a citizen to be able to vote and participate in the voting process.
I like that. Follow up. And then turning to page 14, top of the page, section 32. We have a requirement that to request an absentee ballot for each state election held within that calendar year for which the voter is eligible to vote. And so this is back to applications for an absentee ballot, specifying that an application requesting delivery of an absentee ballot to an applicant must have these following things. We're adding to declare an affiliation under AS 1507-075, which I believe is the political party affiliation. So we're saying that application has to include that. And then we're also saying that it has to include this option for each state election held within that calendar year for which the voter is eligible to vote. I guess my first question is, so what happens if an application doesn't include that? A political party or someone is sending out an application and they're using last year's template before the bill passed. Is that, obviously that's illegal, but I guess what happens in that situation? Are there any consequences to that?
Thank you, and through the chair, Representative Eastman. So I believe currently, and I'll have to ask Ms. Venumiai on this, that a person can change their party affiliation when they do a absentee application. We're just putting it in statute, but I believe you're asking a little bit further detail that would say that somebody is sending out absentee application to those that are out that they would like to have vote by mail, a third party, and they omit this opportunity to change your party affiliation, what would the consequences be? I don't have the answer to that. So if I may, I'd like to punt that one to either Department of Law or, sorry, Division Legal, there we go, or to Ms. Venumiai.
Mr. Klein, let's start with you.
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services for the record. Could you repeat the question? I'm not sure I followed.
Yes. So if someone unfortunately doesn't follow this requirement, and this specific requirement I'm talking about is on lines 2 and 3 of page 14, the requirement to request an absentee ballot for each state election held within that calendar year for which the voter is eligible to vote. If the application is not printed in such a way that it includes that opportunity, say someone's using an application from a prior election or election cycle or isn't aware of this new requirement, in any event, they print the ballot application, they send it to the voter or potential voter, and this language is absent. Will that invalidate the application if the voter tries to use that to apply for an absentee ballot? Will there be some kind of sanctions for the political party or individual who's sending out that incorrectly prepared absentee ballot application?
Again, for the record, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services, through the chair to Representative Eastman. First of all, the requirement that the application include that the application allow someone to request a ballot for each state election within that calendar year, that's current law. That's not being changed in this bill. In terms of what the Division of Elections would do with an application that didn't include this, I don't know that there's any provision in law that explicitly lays out what the Division should do with an application that doesn't include the required parts. I don't know if the Division's ever received an application like that. It might have a historical practice, but I don't know what's been done in the past.
Director Venumiai, can you speak to the Division's practice in this scenario?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman. So an absentee ballot application, this section here is talking about, when you apply to vote by mail, that it allows the voter the opportunity to register to vote, which our application already does. Declaring a party affiliation is not a requirement of registering to vote. That's not one of the requirements that's in the statute. So if somebody, the way I read it is that the ballot application submitted by mail under this section must permit the person to register to vote, which it does, to declare an affiliation. If any, a voter doesn't have to declare an affiliation at the time they register to vote.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tucker.
Thank you. And through the chair, Ms. Venumiai, I think the question more is, what we have is we've been having many organizations send out vote by mail absentee applications out to voters. And here we're allowing a voter to change their party affiliation with that request by adding in here to declare an affiliation under the statutes. What would happen if an organization sent out an absentee application and did not have the checkoff box or a place for someone to change their party affiliation? What would happen with that application?
Well, the requirements for what is, through the chair, Representative Tuck, this is Gail from the Division of Elections. The requirements for an application for a by mail ballot are in regulation, and they're listed in 6 AAC 25505.
Okay.
And it's my understanding that I believe it, I'm looking on here, this list. It says that the application must include already and must include the applicant, a spot for the applicant to designate a political group or group affiliation. But that's not required for them to get a ballot anymore because there's no longer a two-ballot primary system. I think I need to look into this a little bit better so I can more eloquently explain what's required when you apply for a by-mail ballot and what's required when you register to vote. I'd be happy to get back to the committee on that.
Thank you. That sounds good. Representative Eastman, I'm going to put you on pause. Representative Kaufman?
Very good.
Thank you. Through the chair to Director Fanume. I think we talked about this a little bit earlier, but something's still been tugging at me. On page 16, very bottom of the page, where with respect to postmarks or barcode coding, and I guess I'm wondering, I know if I had to, you know, visually confirm a postmark, I could do it at a site, but are you able to confirm the postal tracking? Is that something that can be done in the field, so to speak?
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, currently the division does not have the ability to do that. I believe we would have to work in partnership with the Postal Service. I don't know if there's a certain, you know, if an entity can purchase the equipment to read that barcode that the Postal Service puts on there or not. I don't have that information.
Ms. Holt, do you have any information you can share?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Hillary Hall, National Vote at Home, through the chair. Yes, there are other states. Ohio was one of the leaders in this that have utilized barcodes, so the technology and information exists, and then it's just a matter of adapting that for Alaska. It might also be another one of those things to work with ballot tracks because they're already using that information, and there may be something they can do to continue to track the ballots as they go through the process.
Thank you. Follow-up? I would say to the bill sponsor, if we could get more information on that to confirm that it's something that we can really do, and maybe know, you know, the fiscal note around that, all the things that we would have to know to be sure that we're not saying something that can't be done easily. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. We had testimony previously from a woman, Amber Reynolds, who is on the governing board or the director of the United States Postal Service. They have the ability to do this now. And oftentimes, divisions of elections work closely with the Postal Service when it gets close to election time. And she says that the technology is there. We just got to make sure that we can deliver the technologies to rural Alaska specifically. It would be nice to invite her back to explain that a little bit further, but she gave me certainty that they would be able to, in cooperation with Division of Elections, provide that service for us.
Before we go back to Representative Eastman, further questions from Representative Tarr, Representative Vance, Representative Klayman? Representative Eastman, we'll give you one more line of questioning. I think at some point we may have to commend you to work with the sponsor or the director of the Division of Elections to follow up on other questions you have, just in the interest of budgeting time in the committee at some extent. Representative Vance,
yes,
is that a belated
question? I do have one more delayed question.
Okay, we'll give you that opportunity, then we'll go to Representative Eastman.
Thank you. This is for Ms. Vanumiai regarding the ballot tracking and with the ballot tracks. Does the tracking system with ballot tracks include some type of barcode, and does that originate from the division?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, so there is an intelligent mail barcode that tracks the ballot as it leaves the mail station. There is not a barcode on the return envelope that would track it as it is returned back from the voter, nor does it like track the out, you know, the outbound to the voter throughout the various stages. But it does notify the voter that their ballot has been mailed, and then it would notify the voter that the ballot has been received by the division when we log them.
Follow up. Does this ballot track software have the ability for us to choose if we wanted to track the ballot throughout the whole process? Like, for instance, when I track my mail, I can see my package is still stuck in Kentucky, and then I see when it arrives in Anchorage. Does this ballot tracks have the ability, the option for us to choose that?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I don't know the answer to that question. I think it has to do with an intelligent mail barcode that has to be applied to each voter's return envelope. So I need to look into that a little bit more. Ms. Hall might have some more information about that. This is our first go around with ballot tracks, and at this point in time, it's being used, you know, at the bare minimum level, I should say.
Great, thank you. I think that would be helpful on, you know, if a person says I mailed it, and the division's like, well, I don't know what happened, I never received it. That doesn't support confidence in our voters either. So if we could kind of shore that up, that'd be good.
Representative Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Ms. McReynolds would be able to answer some of these questions, because she basically said the United States Postal Service can track this as if it was a FedEx package or something else. And you can see where it hits here. You can see where it hits there. You can see. Now, going out, I don't know. And so we'll have to ask her that question, because that's two different envelopes, right? You have one going out. Mm-hmm. They open that up, fill out their ballot, put it in the other ballot, and then that comes back. So I think it might be a two-step process of making sure that the going out and coming in matches before it goes out, and then you're able to track it both ways.
And I'll just go quickly to Hillary Hall in case she has any insight on this. Ms. Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Hillary Hall, National Vote at Home Institute. And yes, it can track it through the system using the intelligent mail barcode. And the vendor that you're currently using for your special election has that ability to add those barcodes both on the outgoing and the return portion of it. And again, there is a learning curve, but there are lots of people there able to help with that process. And BallotTracks also has great experience with that.
Thank you, Ms. Hall. Representative Eastman.
May I conclude the previous line of question before the last one?
Yes, you
okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you. So we're still in Section 32, and we're dealing with the requesting the absentee ballot application and or filling it out, rather. Now, you're changing on line 5 a may not to a shall, and specifically the sentence would read, with the changes, an absentee ballot application submitted by electronic transmission under this section shall include a provision that permits a person to register to vote under the statute listed. And my question, similar to what we were talking about a moment ago, is so we're requiring, if it's by mail, that the application include these things, including the ability to associate with a party. But in the next sentence, we're now changing the provision for electronic transmission. We're not making that same requirement, which is interesting. Be curious to know why we wouldn't want to make that same requirement apply there. Same thing for, you know, each of the state elections in that calendar year. All those requirements aren't specifically listed for an electronically transmitted absentee ballot application. And then, of course, the may not is becoming a shall, and I'm just kind of wanting to flesh out why are we – before it was may not, now we're making it a requirement. So I just want to better understand that sentence.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Through the chair, currently we don't have a means of being able to register to vote electronically. And so what this allows, the reason why they changed the shall to may not is because when you do your absentee ballot application, now we're saying that you shall include a provision that permits a person to register to vote, because we now have the ability to be able to do it electronically. So, and this is only specifically for if you're doing an absentee ballot application submitted by electronic transmission. So it just allows that provision, whether you do it through your application process, your absentee application process here, or you do it in your initial application, you can still do it electronically.
Thank you. And last question.
Representative East.
Thank you. Appreciate the indulgence of the chair. On page 15, section 34, we have a provision that's saying after the day of the election, ballots may not be accepted unless received by mail. And I know there's other provisions of the bill that talk about ballots being able to be either rejected or not rejected based on being received by the division by means other than mail. I just wanted to make sure there wasn't a conflict there, because here in section 34, we're specifically saying that ballots may not be accepted unless received by mail, but elsewhere in the bill, we're talking about other ways the division can receive those ballots.
Mr. Mason.
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck. So as we noted earlier, not all mail is postmarked, but with the tracking barcode that we have out there, in theory, you would be able to prove that the ballot was actually mailed before Election Day. So what this allows is that even if it's not postmarked, if you can prove through the intelligent mail tracking barcode that it was mailed on or before Election Day, it can be counted.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, that is one of the issues that we were trying to solve, because now that the Division of Elections is going to be able to send out ballots with a returned postage, so a voter no longer has to come up with the postage. Usually that's kind of a little code on there that says postage paid by sender or whatever it happens to be. There's not a postmark on that. And in speaking with Ms. McReynolds, who's the governing board of directors for the United States Postal Service, about how do we verify that somebody has mailed that, that's why they have the ballot tracking method. I mean, not ballot tracking, just mail tracking method with the Postal Service. So that helps correct that problem as well. So through ballot tracking or through this new method that they're coming out with the United States Postal Service, we will be able to know, even though there's not a postmark on that envelope, when somebody mailed that ballot.
I appreciate that. And that is helpful. And that allows for the use by mail. I'm zeroing in on the fact that we're requiring here and the language that's going to be kept is ballots may not be accepted unless received by mail, which would, I think, rule out things like courier or some other means of getting it. And I'm just, is it the fact that after the election, we want to be more restrictive? And so prior to the election, you can have your spouse drop it off for you or something like that. But it would appear with this language that, you know, after the election, you wouldn't be able to do any of those other things. And is that why that restriction is there? And we're sure that it doesn't conflict with the other means of delivery that we allow for elsewhere in the bill.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, are you asking, because right now we have existing language, we make the exception if it's not postmarked to be able to receive after the day of the election. But I don't think it's anyone's intent that somebody delivers a ballot to the Division of Elections after Election Day. If they didn't vote in person, and if they were somehow having a ballot, or if they didn't drop it into an official drop box, once Election Day and time is closed, unless somebody had mailed it timely, there should be no reason why the Division of Elections should be accepting any further ballots by any type of delivery. What's nice about the United States Postal Service is that it is still a government entity that we can rely on and feel safe and secure.
Thank you very much.
Great. Representative Kaufman, comment or a question?
A question. I don't know what we'll see. Back to on the same subject, earlier line of conversation about how could you field verify that, and we discussed, you know, the postal service systems. I guess I just want to be sure that the other piece of that is that how can a field observer be sure of that, you know, that a batch of ballots after the fact have not come in and are being run, and then you know, later on you find out from the postal service that, oh, well, no, those were late. So there's two layers to it, in other words. So how for those that are working to run the ballots, it's one thing, but for the observers, it's another question. I mean, I could say, well, I see postmarks on those envelopes. But if you can't in the field verify the barcode process, I guess I just think that's an area that we need to explore more in both respects. Thank you. And thanks for letting me squeeze that in.
If I may, Mr. Chair, I think there was a question there. The question is, when you say field observer, through the chair, are you referring to a poll watcher out at a polling location? Or are you referring to a observer once ballots have been received? I'm not quite following the term field observer.
Thank you, through the chair. Yes, well, I kind of made that term up, but I'm just talking about those that are working with the ballots to do the actual processing of them. They have to be able to know what they're getting, but then also the watchers are going to have to be able to tell. So our system has to be transparent enough to facilitate both purposes, the doing and the monitoring, i.e. watching of it.
Okay, and through the chair, I'm going to assume that we're talking about an observer.
Brief hitties. Back on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The observer who is watching the whole balloting process. And so I think one of the things we need to make sure, and I believe I understand correctly, that we want to make sure that observer that's watching these ballots, that as we're observing the ballots and going through the absentee process of verifying and so on and so forth, and the question ballots verifying and so forth, that we can tell somehow there's a verification for the observer to know that ballot was mailed in time. That's a very good point, and I would have to wait till Amber McReynolds or maybe Ms. Hall can explain that currently.
Ms. Hall.
I apologize, but can you rephrase that? I want to make sure I heard it correctly.
Representative Kaufman, can you state the scenario that you are looking to get clarity on?
Thank you. Through the chair. Yes, what I was asking, so the old school system of having a visible postmark on a mailed ballot is observable. As we transition to the use of barcodes, that can be verified, but I'm wondering how it's verified by those that are out there working at what I would call it as the work front. So there are those that are processing the ballots, and there are those that are observing the processing of the ballots. And I'm wondering how by relying on a barcode, is that an observable, verifiable process for both the people doing it and the people trying to observe it to be sure that a bunch of ballots that came in after the fact or that were not mailed in time are not indeed being processed?
Thank you for that. Through the chair, Hillary Hall, National Vote at Home. Representative, there's a couple options on that. One is through chain of custody. So working with your post office, so when the date, because the post office is the one that needs to deliver these ballots after the election, as you discussed earlier, then what you make sure is that they do not deliver any ballots for several days after that cutoff, because again, now there's no rush to get those, and then the late ballots are then actually held at the post office. So that's one of, that's a tactical way to address the issue, and then through chain of custody, showing that these ballots have come through as the election division tracks those processes now. In addition to that, and this is where, you know, working with the Postal Service and then other states that are further ahead on have done integrated this a bit more, is utilizing reports that go with those postal codes. So your observers may not be the ones who can verify that, but it could become part of your canvassing process to ensure that the ballots that came in after Election Day were, in fact, allowed to be counted. And so for some states, that's part of the verification process along with signature verification before they're open.
Thank you, and thanks for letting me get that.
Absolutely. Mr. Mason, briefly.
If you don't mind, Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck through the chair. Gail Fanoum and I can probably add some clarity here. But all of those ballots, the absentee ballots, are reviewed by the Absentee Ballot Counting Review Board, I believe is the correct title. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe that that process is observable. So, but Ms. Fanoum and I probably has more info than I do.
Director Fanoum, can you confirm Mr. Mason's statement?
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, the absentee review process is observable, as many people have attested to today. And I would imagine, and I don't know much about this postal barcode that's being proposed, but if it is an intelligent mail barcode, if it's the same thing, I would imagine that should the post office need to be contacted to determine whether or not that barcode can prove that the ballot was postmarked on time, that would still be noted on the ballot envelope prior to it being opened.
Thank you. We have limited committee time to some extent, and it's my assessment that some of the questions we're wandering into are of interest to 1 to 2/7 of the committee's membership. So at some point, committee questions may need to be taken on an extracurricular basis, spending time with some of the people available to the committee, be it the director of the Division of Elections or other Division of Elections staff, Vote at Home Institute, the sponsor's office, the Department of Law, or others. So in terms of just managing that balance, I sort of feel through the course of this hearing that we may have struck that balance sometime between the 4 to 4:30 mark. And so I'm going to encourage members, as they have additional questions, to pursue those extracurricular, because ultimately, life is about prioritization and choices. And so with committee time on the record, we have to use that time for the highest priority questions that exist. So if there are additional high priority lines of questions, we may have the opportunity to pursue them in the future. But having used more than 2 hours today, I think sort of hit that balance about halfway through, I think we may look to move forward. So as previously noted, we'll distribute the CS to committee members as soon as we get it. Mr. Klein, I think, has been withheld from working on that CS by being with us for most of this committee hearing. Thank you very much, Mr. Klein, for your work. So we'll hold HB 66 per the plan previously noted. For members, I know I noted this previously, but if you're thinking about amendments, you should be in an action posture. And we may start considering amendments on Tuesday, depending on the time of receipt of the CS. So I hope that seems reasonable, balancing all the considerations we have in front of us. I do want to move to SB 66, Senator Begich's legislation, and take up at least a couple of amendments. Per conversation before committee, we will hold this legislation for further review and dialogue between committee members and the sponsor. For amendment number 1, A.A.4, I move amendment number 1. There's an objection, and we have staff Senator Begich with whom this amendment was drafted in conjunction with. Ms. Colbert, could you speak to amendment number one?
Hello, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's Mercedes Colbert, staff to Senator Begich, and he sends his regrets that he was unable to make it today, and thank you for bringing this bill up again before you today. For amendment A.A.4 before you, this amendment simply, the short version is that this amendment proposal creates four alternates for both Legislative Council and the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. They are alternates for the members of the Senate Majority, Senate Minority, House Majority, and House Minority Caucuses for both of these committees. Legislative Council does not already have alternates in statute. So Section 2 that is listed there on the first page, Section 2 creates those alternates for it for Legislative Council. Section 4, which goes on to page from bottom of page 1 into page 2, that increases the number of alternates from 2 to 4 in the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, and it ensures that at least one represents each of those minority caucuses. So in Section 2 of the amendment before you, it's again, this isn't already in statute, so this creates that statute for Leg Council alternates. You'll note that currently there actually is an alternate serving for, at least on the Senate side for Leg Council. That is more just a traditional appointment. It's not actually set in statute. It's an understanding between members when they're organizing. And that is, and that has been the case in the past, not always, but sometimes. So this makes sure that we have alternates for both all four caucuses in Legislative Council set in statute. And if you'd like, I can read it, or I can move on to the LBNA side in more detail.
Please proceed to LBNA side.
Sure. On the LBNA side, again, it increases from 2 to 4. Currently, right now, the LBNA alternates really only serve if a quorum is needed. This actually makes sure that a minority member has an alternate that can serve on LBNA. And I believe Representative Eastman brought this up in committee last time, and it was a very good point, is that if you are the one minority member on LBNA and you're unable to attend, you will have a fellow caucus member sit in on your behalf so that, especially when you have executive sessions, you have somebody there to listen in and report back to your caucus. So that's the intent there, is that minority members always have somebody there, preferably. And likewise, the majority also has an alternate member in the event somebody is not able to attend.
Thank you, Ms. Colbert. Questions from the committee? Representative Eastman?
Thank you, and to the maker of the amendment. What would your thoughts, or what would the sponsor's thoughts be on eliminating the quorum requirement? Because right now, I think, since it's just when, in the case of Leg Council, there's 14 members, so the only time alternates would be able to stand in would be if you have 8 people missing. So you're down to, or 7 people missing, you have less than 8, which is a quorum. And it would seem to me it would be a shame if, you know, you had 8 people there and the alternates were also there and would like to participate, but they're told, sorry, there's 8 people here. If there were 7, you could participate, but we don't need you.
Through the chair, Mercedes Colbert. Thank you, Representative Eastman. I believe Senator Begich is open to that. We've talked about that too, and he's open to consider eliminating that quorum requirement. So if it is the will of the committee, he would be okay with that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Eastman, do you maintain your objection to amendment number one?
Yes, given that, and I don't want to jump the gun on anybody, but I would like to introduce a conceptual amendment that would remove that quorum requirement. And so in the event that, for example, in the case of the minority, the person representing the minority is absent, then the alternate for the minority could fill their place, regardless of whether there's quorum or not.
Great. With that in mind, I think I'm going to move to table amendment number one, and we're going to adjourn this meeting. And Senator Begich and Representative Eastman can take this up on their own time outside committee. So we'll hold the rest of the amendments and follow the lead of the sponsor with amendment number one tabled. And at 5:24, we are going to adjourn.